As many of you may be aware, on Monday that just passed, Ajahn Brahma Wongso, the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society here, began a six-month retreat at the monastery, doing solitary, secluded meditation practice for now until the 16th of June next year, when he will come out of retreat if nothing untowards happens in the meantime. We have given him the opportunity to take a break from his many teaching duties. And over the years, I'm sure many of you are aware, he has given full-heartedly to the community here as well as to the monastic community. So it is a chance for the lay community and the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery to give 100% to him, to allow him to do 6 months in total seclusion. So he is in a hut at the end of the monastery. It's in one of the second valleys, which is a quiet area of the monastery. We've chained off the road on the two entrances. We were going to suggest up bricking up the door once he's entered the hut, but because that's an ancient Tibetan tradition. When a monk would do a retreat, the monk staying in the monastery would get some bricks and mortar and brick up the doorway and just leave a hole big enough to send in food, close off the cave. I did joke with him that if we were going to brick up his doorway, I'd put two bad bricks in the door, two bricks on an angle, just for him to contemplate. And just on that, one person who visited our monastery said quite humorously that these days this program on television called Big Brother is very popular. And you can get little cameras, and we could put a camera in his hut, so all the people at the Buddhist Society could log on and check out what he's doing. But we didn't think that that would make very good viewing, seeing a monk sitting meditation, because most people in the world want stimulation. They're looking for action, they're looking for activity, they're looking for sex, they're looking for violence, they're looking for excitement, they're looking for stimulation of the senses. To see a person sitting very quietly and very still for long, long periods of time, it's not exciting. But there's something very profound happening there. And just as when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, he wasn't doing anything exciting. Still, but there was something very deep and very profound happening in his mind, in his heart, and so something really internally exciting was happening. Something miraculous was occurring, and that was the destruction of craving, that is the source of all suffering. And by the destruction of that very craving, that led to his liberation from greed, hatred and delusion. And because of his liberation, he became a light unto the world, lighting up what we call the three world systems. He gave brilliance. And it's because of the Buddha's enlightenment, because of his enlightenment, it allows those of us who are also interested in a path of peace, in a path of liberation, in a path of freedom, in a way out of our conflict, in a way out of our disappointments, in a way out of our dissatisfaction, searching for a way out of imperfection. It gives us the light of the path, a direction, a goal. Without a person becoming liberated to truth, without a Buddha arising in the world, none of us would have this opportunity. None of us would know a direction. We would be lost in the dark. And so having a discoverer. And that's what the word Buddha means. The Buddha is a title. The word Buddha means the awakened one or the enlightened one. And it is a title given to a human being who has discovered the pathway to enlightenment and has realized and walked that path until they have fully obtained enlightenment. So it's an honorific title, just like we would give a title of Prime Minister or President to a person who takes that position. It doesn't matter who that person is. It's the same with the title of the Buddha. It doesn't matter who discovers that truth. Once they have discovered it, they are called a Buddha. And the Buddha is the person who first discovers that truth. That's the title of the name to the person who first sees the Dhamma. But truth, what Buddhists call Dhamma, is always there, isn't it? It is just nature, the natural phenomena of existence. Before a Buddha arose in the world, nature was still there. Beings were born, they grew old, sick and died. There was happiness and there was sorrow. There was wars, there was joys, there was disappointments. But people did not know a way out of that. They just knew that. They knew the world. They knew the experiences of the world. They sought ways of happiness, ways of freedom in the world. But because they did not know a path beyond the world, they were still caught in it. And so Dhamma, at the time before the Buddha's enlightenment, Dhamma was still there. But it was the Buddha, Siddhartha, Gautama, who discovered that truth, saw it within himself by sitting still under the shade of a tree. So this evening, we're not sitting under the shade of a tree, but we're sitting under the shade of this roof. And we also have to be very still to calm the mind down, to turn inwards, to find some inner tranquility, inner contentment, inner peace, and inner harmony. And to do that, we also have to know the path. And to know the path, we are very fortunate because we have a teacher who has gone before us. And this evening, I did want to say something about teachers, our guides, because it is relevant that Ajahn Romawongso, who has been many of our teachers, has been our teacher for many of us, has taken a break, gone on retreat. And I thought to talk about this subject of teachers, but begin back to the great teacher. For all Buddhists, the Buddha is the greatest teacher of them all. That is the greatest meditation teacher. We have that faith, we have that confidence, we have that trust, that conviction. Because having read and understood those teachings, it brings up trust and confidence that this person may know the path in a way that I do not know it. This person sees something that I do not see or understands something that I have not understood. So with greater study, with greater practice, we start to open our minds up to the potential of the path of liberation. Does this path work for us? And when we come across Buddhism in the beginning, we don't know, do we? We come from doubt, we come from confusion, we come from a search, we come from sincerity and honesty, we want to know, we want to seek a truth. And sometimes that path, that search, there's a lot of cynicism, sometimes a lot of distrust because we've been disappointed many times before. And there are often many false teachers, false gurus, people who claim to know, who don't know. And so, naturally, we want to find out what is true and what is right for us, but also what is not going to harm us, what is not going to waste our time or take us on a false path. And when we come styles of teaching, initially we come from a quality of not knowing. We do not understand yet. But one of the great and beautiful qualities that I found in Buddhism when I came from this point of wanting to know but lacking the trust, wanting to find truth but not really knowing if this path was for me, was that I wasn't asked to believe first. I was told, just try it and see if it works for you. Does the path of virtue improve your life by keeping a high ethical standard, by living and rising up to qualities of kindness and generosity? How does that affect your being? How does that change the state of your mind, the state of your life? And by trying to abide and live by the five precepts, I definitely saw that there was a definite change in my life. There was a security, there was a stability. I had a sense of trust in myself. I had a sense of refuge, that if I couldn't trust anything else in the world, trust goodness. If I couldn't trust anything else in the world, I could trust virtue. Not meaning I have to trust the virtue in others, but I can trust the virtue within myself. And that gives you a lot of stability. It becomes your ship on the great ocean, on the waves of samsara, the endless round of birth. Because sometimes we feel lost in life. Sometimes we feel like we're overwhelmed by the ups and downs of life. And unless we have a raft, unless we have a ship, unless we have something we can cling to, something we can hold on to first until we pass over the great ocean, then we'll drown, won't we? And one of the things that the Buddha encouraged us to do was to not believe, but just give it a try. Try to abide by virtue. Try to abide by what is good and noble and wholesome. To develop qualities of sila, ethical standards based in harmlessness, based in honesty, based in trust, based in truthfulness, and based in clarity. That's the five precepts: not killing, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, and not taking drugs and intoxicants that lead to confusion. We can see that in this world so many problems is caused by violence, is caused by lack of honesty, is caused by sexual impropriety. How much pain is caused by that? How much pain is caused by dishonesty and by carelessness and heedlessness. We can see that pain in the world, but what we can do is take moral responsibility. We can give it a try, abide by those standards, and see whether it works. Just recently I heard a talk by one of the monks who travelled with Ajahn Chah to America. And one of Ajahn Chah's comments when he went to the States over 20 years ago was that in this day and age, many people are interested in knowledge. It's the knowledge age, the age of knowledge, the age of information. People worship information. People worship knowledge. But people have lost the respect. Do not worship virtue anymore. How much better the world would be if we gave our reverence and homage and worshipped virtue more than knowledge. There would be a lot more kindness, there would be a lot more care, a lot more compassion in the world. So keeping virtue and ethical standard is our teacher, it's our guide. We see whether this works for us. We apply it in our daily life. If I live by this standard, how does it affect me? And what influence does it have on others? And it does have an effect. It does have an influence. We can rise up. We can be an example to others just by being kind, by being caring, by being ethical in an unethical world. But if we demand the rest of the world to be kind and virtuous to others, we'll be very disappointed. We have to light a candle in the darkness, not demand the darkness to go away. We have to change that darkness ourselves by changing ourselves. That's what we can do. Just as Siddhartha Gautama was unenlightened, he was able to change himself by practicing a path of virtue, samadhi, calm and concentration, and wisdom. And so the Buddha's teachings is always pointing you towards the teacher, which is the first person who discovered this path, the Buddha, but also pointing you towards realization yourself. That was one quality that my teacher Ajahn Chah always had. Was he wasn't expecting the people who came to him to become his disciples, often quite the opposite. Those people who became very attached to Ajahn Chah and wanted to be around him all the time, especially those monks, he would always send them off to the furthest monastery, the most impoverished, the most secluded, the one that was hard to get to him. So that they would become self-reliant, so they wouldn't become reliant on him, but they'd become reliant on truth, they'd become reliant on the Dhamma, they'd become reliant on themselves. They would become, as the Buddha said, become an island unto yourself. You have to make your own island, your own raft, and make that island pleasant place to live, a beautiful place. And we can do that by developing wholesome qualities, developing wholesome states. And so Ajahn Chah was never one to have disciples attached to him. He was one who would always make you reliant on your own understanding. Whenever you would often when you would ask him questions, he would turn the question on its head so that you would seek the answer yourself, so that you weren't dependent on the teacher, but you're dependent on yourself, because we know ourselves the best. Some people have actually come and asked me in the monastery, "Venerable, can you read my mind?" And I say, "Well, can you read your mind?" You do not have to seek someone else outside yourself to read your mind. You know your mind better than anyone else. The thing is to get to know that mind, to understand it, to understand its likes, its dislikes, its attractions, its repulsions, its fears, its anxieties, wholesome states and unwholesome states, to understand the psychology of the mind, how to develop that mind, how to improve that mind, how to purify that mind, how to make that mind rise up and grow. If you find that and trust in that, trust in what you can know within yourself, trust in what we call the Buddha, the one that knows. What do you know within yourself? We can know this present moment, can't we? We can know what's happening here and now. We can know what we're thinking. We can know what we're feeling. We can know the problems, the distractions, the difficulties, all the pleasures and joys of life. We can know that here and now. We don't have to ask anybody else. the trouble is, once we know that, what do we do with it? That's often, we can know, but what do we do with it? We have to have a skillful means, a skillful path to sort out what's coming up, the moods, the emotions, the thoughts and the ideas. And that comes back to a skillful path of training the mind. But we rely on this guide, this teacher of the knower, that quality of the Buddha within ourselves. What can we know? What can we realize? What can we see? What can we understand? And so it's not reliant on an outer teacher, but it is in some ways dependent on a guide. And that's what a teacher is. They're a guide. They're a skillful a person who has, out of compassion, our welfare as their highest regard. Concern for our well-being, hoping that we too will also obtain freedom, obtain liberation, know as they too have known. So the next quality that we have as our teacher, as our guide, is the quality of peace. And that's what we turn to. We can know whether we're peaceful or we're not. We can know the distraction and restlessness of the mind. We can know when the body is stressed, when the body is calm. We can know when the mind is happy, when it's joyous, and we can know the opposite. So by using skillful means, we can calm this mind down. And we need to develop skillful means in our life of calming the mind down. Sometimes it's just by taking in a deep breath. When things get too much, just take in a very deep breath and let go. And sometimes we need to put space between ourselves and a situation by taking a holiday, or coming to a monastery, or going for a walk on the beach. Go amongst nature, just to calm down and relax and unwind. Meditation retreat, go and visit a good friend, share a quiet moment with nature. That calms the mind down. Sometimes we need to pick up a word which is meaningful to us and say it over and over again. Be at peace, be at peace. Or it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. Let go. There was a monk I know in Thailand. He had in his monastery, when people would come to visit him, hanging on the entrance to his monastery was a scale. And on that scale, there was two potatoes, like sweet potatoes, on either side of the scale. And whenever someone would come with a problem, he would point to the scale with the two potatoes on, because it was a play on words in Thai. It means it doesn't matter, because the same word for scale means it doesn't, and the same word for potatoes means is the same word for matter. So whenever they'd come up with a problem, he would just point to the scales with the two potatoes on, and then people at first couldn't figure out what he meant. And after a while, they would see the play on words. It doesn't matter. So sometimes we have to remind ourselves, these simple use of words to remind ourselves, these words are skillful because they're meaningful. To remind ourselves, sometimes it doesn't matter. Let it go. Be at peace. Be calm. Be still. Listen to silence. When we say these words over and over again, they're very calming on the mind. And many of the forest meditation monks would use words. For example, the word buddho. You've heard many mantras. Some of the monks like to use the word Arahang, Arahang, Arahang. Arahang means the enlightened one, the Arahant. We all want to be free, we all want to be enlightened. So just to say a word that is meaningful, which means enlightenment, reminds us of what we're aiming for, reminds us of the goal, focuses the direction of the mind and calms it down. And when we calm the mind down, we start to relax. And when we relax, the mind opens up. Because so much of our mind is taken with controlling. And if you're having trouble with meditation, it's often because you're trying to be in control. And you get too tense. And then when you get too tense, you relax too much and you go to sleep. And then you tense up again, put too much effort in. So we're going through those two extremes of effort. So just give up the controller. As Ajahn Chah used to say, get out of the way and let the meditation happen. Often our problems with dealing with the mind is we have a sense of I in charge that gets in the way and doesn't just see what's happening, isn't just the neutral observer, the silent witness, the conscious knowing, subtle watching. These are the qualities of mindfulness. It's neutral. It just knows what's coming up and what's going away. It's not judgmental. It's not involved. It's not trying to change anything. It's not trying to control. Just like when we were sitting a moment ago and I suggested being very, very still. It's very hard to be still. And sometimes we try hard to be still, and that makes us restless because we're trying to do something. To be still, we actually have to notice stillness. It's a sense of awareness. It's not trying to do anything to be still. It is just noticing stillness. Just like we can notice the gaps between the words that are being said. There's a silence. And sometimes silences carry weight. They're very, very meaningful. Meaningful silences. When we give our attention to the gaps, to the space between things, we notice the stillness. Just like when we're reading a book, if we have all the printing filling the whole page and every space, every gap on the page, it becomes very difficult to read. The words run together, the sentences run together. Therefore, the page loses its interest and loses its meaning. But we have gaps between words. We have gaps between paragraphs. We have gaps on the edges of a page because they give visual impression to the mind. They give meaning to the words, give meanings to the paragraphs. So to give meaning to our life, we need moments of silence and we need to give attention to silence. Because so much of our life is giving attention to activity, attention to noise, attention to distraction, attention to what's going on, attention to movement. So the mindful state is a state which turns to what is still and what is calm. And as we notice silence more and more, we notice it's actually a pleasurable state, that being in motion all the time, being active all the time, being restless all the time, is very tiresome, it's very stressful. It's what we call dukkha, what is stressful. being still is what is peaceful. And as we dwell in that peace, then the mind becomes very, very joyous and very happy. Very happy to be still, very happy to be blissful, to be happy to be relaxed and calm, to be focused and be one-pointed. And then that becomes our teacher. We realize that there's something within our side of our own minds, within ourselves, which can know this peace, which can access this peace, which can turn towards deep tranquility and energize the mind. And therefore we don't need to believe in anybody else. They have told us the way. We've walked that way, that path. And we've seen for ourselves, yes, that is true. There is a still place there. There is a pleasant place there. And once we've been there, we know it's true. So that experience of that truth of peace becomes our teacher, becomes our guide in future. And then we develop the mind in the way of wisdom. And this is the real teacher. Because wisdom in Buddhism doesn't mean being clever. It doesn't even mean being intelligent. It doesn't mean being witty. It means, can we overcome suffering? Whatever difficulty arises in our lives, can we deal with it? That's the real test of a wise person. Are they suffering or not? If we're still suffering, then we're not yet wise. We still haven't seen that thing correctly or truly as it really is. We haven't understood yet. Ajahn Chah used to ask, is a lemon sour? It's only sour if we suck on it, isn't it? Lemon is sour once we suck on it. A lemon sitting in a lemon bowl is just that, isn't it? It's neutral. It's neither sour, sweet. It's just sitting there. You'd never tasted a lemon before. You wouldn't even know what sour meant, what a lemonness is. It's only when we go and suck on the lemon, bite into the lemon, say, this is sour, this is unpleasant. Is a rock heavy? It's only heavy when we pick it up. And so we start to see what he was pointing to, that suffering arises because we have bitten into something. Or picked up something. We've picked up a burden. We've clung on to something. And we've chewed or bit into something. We've taken hold of something. This taking hold of something is what we call clinging. We expect something to satisfy us. And we expect that thing never to change. Very recently, a lady came to see me who was very upset. And she was in tears. And she explained to me that her partner, her boyfriend of 10 years, had left her for a younger lady. And she asked me, what should I do? And I said, develop wisdom. And she said, no, I mean, what should I do about getting my boyfriend back? And I said, whether you get him back or not, you're going to need wisdom. If you get him back, you're going to need a lot more wisdom because you're going to feel very, very unhappy that he left you. If you don't get him back, you're going to even need more wisdom because you're feeling depressed. And she had spoken to one of the junior monks before. He suggested that she come to speak with me. And that junior monk said afterwards, when she said her boyfriend left her, what should I do? He said, I sat for about 4 minutes. And all I could think was, well, that's normal. But I couldn't dare tell her that. So I said, just wait to speak to one of the senior monks. And so what did I do? I told her that's normal. But try to do it in a very tactful way. Because can we control another human being from this point in time forevermore to love us forever? Is that possible? Can we control even our own minds from this point in time to love someone else forever without any change occurring? And that's asking for the impossible, isn't it? It is not in accordance to nature. It's not in accordance to reality. It's not even in accordance to our experience. But why do we insist on it? Why do we attach? Why do we get it wrong all the time? The mind somehow tricks us and thinks that it will be like that. It should be like that. It shouldn't be any other way. And it's that very mind which we call the mind which is ignorant. And ignorance is not a put down, it means to ignore truth. The facts of the situation, as we know it, if we're looking on it objectively, is that this changes. The facts of the situation, of the emotion, is that it changes for us and it changes for others. But why do we insist? Do we ignore those facts and say, but it should be this way? And then when it doesn't turn out the way we think it should be, then the tears start to flow. It's because we've actually ignored the facts. We've ignored even what we know is true for others and for ourselves. Just like Ajahn Chah once told the case of a man who came to see him. He came with a woman. And he was crying. He was very upset. And so Ajahn Chah had to calm him down first before he could get any information out of him. He said, what's upsetting you? And he said, a huge problem, something momentous has happened to me. This is terrible. And then he had burst into tears. And then Ajahn Chah would speak to calm him down. And this gentleman would come to the monastery regularly, all the time, listen to the talks. And then after a long period of time, he calmed down and he said, well, what's this big problem you've got? And he says, my wife has died. And Ajahn Chah said, I thought you said you had a big problem. That's not a big problem. That's just ordinary. People's wives die all the time. People's husbands die all the time. I thought you said you had a big problem. That is ordinary. It happens every day. And will happen every day to endless time. On through this universe. What is out of the ordinary of that? It's because we focus on ourselves. This is my wife, my person I love. We think this is out of the ordinary. But we see that actually it is very ordinary experience. And he said, you've been coming to the monastery. You've been hearing the monks say, you've heard the Buddha say, there is such things as old age, sickness and death. But you haven't understood. You're thinking that your wife will not grow old, sick and die. You have ignored that truth. It's true for everyone else, but not for me. And so it is actually very ordinary, isn't it? It's just like grains in the sand. It's just like the sun rises and the sun sets. Will be old age, sickness, and death. think it's extraordinary, it's out of the ordinary, but actually it's very, very ordinary. It is the norm. It will happen. It's to be expected. So when it does happen, we say, oh, this is nature. This is the way things are. And when we see things with wisdom like that, when we stop ignoring them, then wisdom arises. We're able to deal with the change of life, with the changing circumstances, with much more skill. And Ajahn Chah asked that man, by the way, who's this lady you came with? And he said, oh, that's my second wife. Sounds like he had a second big problem coming up. just to keep Ajahn Brahm's tradition up, I saw when I visited our hardware store. Our hardware is a real, we've got a comedian in our hardware store, and he likes to write little signs up with the witty sayings. And one of the witty sayings I saw last week was, if marriage is made in heaven, isn't that also where thunder and lightning is made? So if you want to live in heaven, expect thunder and lightning as well. Yes? You just can't have one without the other. So this is what we're doing. When we're reflecting, we're not ignoring things. And often we try to ignore, don't we? That's why we have taboos in life. And one of the greatest taboos is to ignore the speaking of death, to ignore our own death. We ignore that. We never give any attention to it. That's what ignorance is, to ignore truth. Because why do we ignore it? Because we find that thing very threatening. Why do we find it threatening? Basically, because we don't understand it. What we don't understand, we fear. What we know clearly, we comprehend. There's lack of fear there. So the way to overcome fear of death is by giving attention to it, by not ignoring it, by contemplating it, giving it some consideration. Am I prepared for the change, which is inevitable, which is ordinary, will happen? One of the things Ajahn Brahm did before he went on retreat, which is something which monks are quite open about, he said, just to explain what's happening, we are putting food in his bowl, taking it to near where he lives, and we have a little tin shed. We put his bowl with food in that shed, and then at a certain time, once the monk who put the food there has left, Ajahn Brahm will come down about 11:15 and take the food without seeing anybody. And he said, if you notice my bowl hasn't been taken, there's still food in my bowl, for 7 days in a row, don't come and disturb me under any circumstances. Because the reason for that is because sometimes when we're practicing, especially for people who are developed on the path, developing deep states of meditation, you can stay in those states for many, many days. Literally. There's no problems with food or drink or bowel movements. The Buddha sat for 7 days and seven nights under the Bodhi tree after his enlightenment, enjoying the bliss and peace of that. So there's no interest in the world. But he said, if you notice there's food in my bowl, it hasn't been taken, there hasn't been any food taken out of my bowl on the eighth day, then you can come and practice your death chants. Okay. Yeah. I said to the monks when Ajahn Brahm went on retreat, then doesn't matter who dies, even if I die, don't tell Ajahn Brahm, we won't disturb him, he can just come out and find out the monastery's empty. And when you can actually talk about the possibility of your own death with a sense of lightness, a sense of ease, then you're getting closer to wisdom. You cannot discuss it, you've never discussed it, never even contemplated, never prepared for it, then you're ignoring it. You're a long way from wisdom and understanding of the inevitable, what is ordinary, what will happen. And so when you look at this thing, oh, this will happen, how am I preparing for it? And it's not the process. The process of death is just the setting of the sun. The sun goes down, and then it comes up again. It's nothing unusual. We die every night when we go to sleep. One day ends, there's a gap, and then hours later, we wake up again. We're born again into the next day. This is this process of passing on. So when we give attention to the possibility, to the potential, what's going to happen, to the inevitable, and look at it with a sense of ease, with a relaxed mind, then we're not ignoring it. Then we're going to get wiser and wiser, not only about death, but actually how we're living right now. Because that's what death does, isn't it? It actually makes us very, very sensitive to the quality of our life here and now, what we're doing here and now, how we're dealing with other people, how we're interacting. And so one of the best forms of meditation for us to develop is to think, this is my last breath. What am I thinking? What am I doing? How am I acting? Would I like to die with this thought, saying these words, doing these deeds? If we can honestly say, I'm very happy to die at this point with this thought in mind, saying these things, doing this deed, then that is a noble life, that is a noble death. Because the last thought of mind is very important. That can be a cause for the rebirth in the next life. It's very significant. How we die. We had a Sinhalese man come to a monastery many years ago, and he brought his family up to offer food to the monks, to take the precepts, to spend the afternoon in the monastery. And before leaving, the family were in a hurry to get into the car, and he said, no, just 1 minute, I want to go up to the main shrine, to our hall, main hall, and I want to pay respects to the Buddha. And he went into the hall and he bowed down to the Buddha image with a lot of devotion. And he stayed bowed down for a long time. And his relatives thought he was making some wish or some determination. But he didn't come up. And they touched him and he passed away, bowing down to the Buddha image. After having made merit, keeping virtue, passing away with a lot of reverence and respect. And they called the monks up. We called an ambulance, but it was obviously far too late. So we did some chanting as the body was lying there and waited for the ambulance to arrive. And that was a beautiful way to go. I thought, well, if I could die like that, I'd be very happy. A very graceful way, very noble way to pass away. A peaceful mind, no pain, and no difficulty. It just us to go calmly and peacefully. And so when we see these things, we start to give attention to things. We start to notice how we're living our lives. If we're getting into good habits of mind and speech and body, then as life processes come to an end, then those habits will come up. I think I told the story one other time, but I'll mention it again, of a Thai man I know. He had two friends, and one of them was saying he was starting to wonder about his meditation practice. He used to go to the monasteries quite often, but he was wondering whether he was really getting anywhere. And both him and his friend were in their 60s, and they used to listen to Dhamma talks by Ajahn Chah and practice meditation. And they did their business and they had families. They're very busy men. But they tried to practice as best they could. And one day they were playing tennis together. And they were playing tennis, and he hit the ball to his partner, the man at the other end. And suddenly he grabbed his heart. And he slowly put himself down on the ground. Then he lifted his leg into the meditation posture and put his hands in meditation and shut his eyes and then passed away. And before his friend could get around to the other side of the court, he died of a heart attack. And he came and told me that he said, now I know the benefits of all my meditation practice and what my friend had been doing. When it mattered, even though they were enjoying a game of tennis, because of the habits, the training, the skillful habit patterns, when it really mattered, he was prepared. He was ready. And he just gracefully went back into the meditation posture and passed away in meditation, making his mind peaceful. So that is a very skillful. Because he hadn't ignored the path of practice. And so, in our spiritual practice, to summarize, our teacher is not only the Enlightened One, the Buddha, but it is that path of training which we too can undertake. We can see the effects of virtue on our lives. We can see the effect of peace in our lives. And we can see the clarity that wisdom gives to our lives. We can develop understanding to overcome problems and difficulties skillfully and wisely. And so that's the teacher. So during this period that Ajahn Brahm is away for 6 months, take wisdom, samadhi, peaceful states, and virtue as your teacher and guide. You do not have to rely on anyone else. Rely on what you can know in yourself. Yes, seek out some advice, some skillful means from others at times. But in the end, it comes down to what we do ourselves. And that we can know ourselves. And that we can change. And may that change lead to happiness and peace for all. So I will end the talk there. Thank you very much. Before we invite James Panakis, our president, up to make the announcements, there is one announcement that traditionally the monks have made, and that is that the Buddhist Society for many, many years has taken on a position of benefactor to an orphanage in Bangladesh. Bangladesh, as you know, is a non-Buddhist country. But there is, in the Chittagong Hills, a small Buddhist community, and they are very impoverished and also trying to practice Buddhism under very difficult circumstances without any support from the government. And there is an orphanage there which the Buddhist Society over many years has been sending funds and donations off. And we usually do it around this time of year, Chris Buddhamas. So if you want want to give some happiness to some young boys and girls who are without parents, then you too can become their parents for 1 year by just maybe giving some kindness, giving some support. We don't normally make requests, but we've felt that this is a very good thing to do, and we've had people from the Buddhist Society go and witness what they're doing there, and they've all come back with great praise and a lot of happiness and encouragement for what they're doing. So if you want to assist with that, how do we actually do that? Yes, there's a bowl on the donation box at the back of the hall for those who want to be a parent to an orphan child for one Christmas.